Welcome to the Dreamcatcher Podcast, a place where you'll receive a boost of inspiration, practical advice, and tools to maximize your success and personal happiness. And that's not all. You'll also get plenty of guidance on how you can use your gifts, talents, and compassion to contribute towards making the world a better place. Be sure to sign up for our free weekly newsletter for a preview of what's in store and to also receive a free ebook. To sign up, simply visit www.thedreamcatch.com. Now it's my pleasure to introduce you to the host of the Dreamcatcher Podcast, Celine Chinoy.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Dreamcatcher Podcast, a place where your dreams can find a voice. Today, I'm introducing you to a different way of seeing the world, an unconventional philosophy that will get you to think differently about yourself and the world around you. Humanism is a movement that promotes free thinking and a tolerant society where rational thinking and kindness prevail. It focuses on helping people develop their own views so that they can be happier and live more fulfilled lives. To give us more insight into humanism, I invited Andrew Copson. Andrew is the chief executive of Humanists UK, and he is the current president of Humanists International. He represents the movement extensively on national television and radio, as well as writing for a number of newspapers. He's also authored two books on the topic. In this interview, Andrew explains the core principles of humanism and how we can use those to create a sense of meaning and nurture a community that's focused on kindness, equality, and contributing to the greater good. I hope that you'll enjoy our conversation and keep an open mind as you take in what Andrew shares with us. And please don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoyed what you heard. Hello, Andrew. So nice to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you? I'm very aware this is the evening for me and the morning for you. I hope you're awake.
Yes, I am, barely. Yeah, we were just talking before this, and I was telling Andrew that I don't usually do interviews this early in the morning. So yeah. So Andrew, now before we start our conversation, I just want to mention something very quickly. So the majority of my listeners are what I would call spiritually inclined. But the reason I wanted to have someone like you on the show is because as a journalist, I want to offer different points of views to my listeners. And I really do think that people can benefit from knowing more about humanism and the key humanistic teachings. And Andrew, you are clearly one of the best people to talk to about it. So I appreciate you being here on the show with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so now that that's out of the way, let's start out with the basics. What is humanism and what are the core beliefs?
Well, no one ever sort of invented humanism as an ideology or a belief and wrote it down and sort of founded it in that way. The word humanism came to be applied about a couple of hundred years ago to a certain set of beliefs and values that, you know, already existed. And these were the ideas that that there's no God, that there's no external objective source of meaning and morality in the universe, but that instead it's up to human beings individually and together as a collective humanity to create meaning in our lives rather than to try to find it somewhere else, and to think for ourselves and take personal responsibility about the question of the best way to live, how we should treat other people and why, and that we have only this one life to do it. You know, humanists are people who naturalists, that we believe in the universe as a natural phenomenon that has no second layer where there might be spirits or gods or other non-material beings. So that's it in a nutshell. It's a non-religious, naturalistic approach to the universe and a human-centered philosophy of personal responsibility and meaning-making.
So would you call it a philosophy?
It's an interesting question. I mean... It is a philosophy in the sense that it's an approach to life. It's a way of it's a view, a worldview that structures how you make your assumptions about things, how you approach other people, how you approach your own responsibilities, how you make sense of what's happening to you, you know, the meaning that you make out of the events that happen to you. So to that extent, it is a philosophy, but it's been called many things. And I think it doesn't really matter, a philosophy, an approach to life, a worldview, a life stance. We have this word in Western Europe, a life stance comes from the Dutch and Norwegians. Any of those things. I prefer approach to life because I think that describes what it is without being grandiose, you know.
Right, right. And I think that's something that humanists try to stay away from, that grandiosity.
And we try and avoid that, yeah, yeah. We don't like the big theories and the overwhelming philosophies because really what humanists tend to try and center and focus is the human being. And so we're probably a little bit suspicious of big systems or big, you know, ideologies. They tend to crush the individual.
Right, right. Yeah, especially, you know, back in the day when religion really took precedence and had a say in everything, you know?
Yeah. Well, in some parts of the world, that's still the case, of course. You know, there are still many parts of the world where religion intrudes and dominates in politics, in uh-huh. in law, in people's lives and their communities. But yeah, in the past, it certainly was the case much more so. I mean, I'm very conscious that I'm talking to you from the UK, which is, you know, one of the least religious societies in the world. We have a huge majority of people with a non-religious identity, a huge majority of people with non-religious beliefs, you know. And we're a country where 90% of people don't go to a place of worship, you know. Even in the United States, that's very different. Those numbers are a lot, you know, almost reversed. So I think that when we talk about what things were like in the past and what they're like today, I think we always have to remember that actually the world is quite diverse. I know that, you know, from being president of Humanist International, the sort of life that I can, you know, the sort of philosophy that I've just even outlined is criminal in some countries. You know, there are countries where it is a criminal offense to have the sort of beliefs that I've just described. So the situation for humanists is very diverse right now in the world. It's not persecution, is not just in the past.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I can imagine. What are the statistics like? How do you know how many people subscribe to this way of living?
It's a difficult one because no one gathers information on people's okay. life philosophies or life stances in the world. I mean, there's data on people's religion, but no one really knows what an individual respondent to a survey means when they say, you know, I'm a Christian or I'm a Muslim or I'm a Jew or I'm of no religion or I'm a Hindu or whatever. Because, you know, what are they really saying? Are they saying that's my identity, but I don't really believe it? Are they saying that's what I really believe? I really fundamentally believe it. Are they saying that's just a sort of cultural affinity for them? So it's hard to measure non-religious philosophies and non-religious beliefs. There are some in countries that have a very sort of developed national polling system, for example. There are value surveys out there that tell us. And so in a country like the UK, about 30% of people have a humanist view, but only about 6% of people identify as humanists. So beliefs and identity is very different as well. In Norway, where the humanist organization is much bigger, it's something like 25% of people who identify as humanists and over 50% of people who have humanist beliefs. So I think you have to, when you talk about non-religious views, you have to try and measure them in a different way. You have to ask a series of questions to try and sort of get at, you know, people's ultimate worldview. It's not as simple as saying, you know, are you a Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, tick this box. And so measuring it is very hard. But there are certainly many millions, tens of millions of people in the world, especially in the Western world, for whom humanism is the implicit common sense worldview that they have.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to belief systems, there's so many shades of gray, right? You just can't put it in a box.
Absolutely. Really. No one's a pure anything. You know,
exactly. No, there's
no pure humanist, pure Christian.
Yeah. 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 So one of the main tenets of humanism is that we're accountable for our life. And you mentioned that briefly, and that we are in control of our destiny and our actions and choices. So how would you account for events that are out of our control? Say, you know, those lucky breaks that we get or any tragic events that happen out of the blue. Is there any kind of explanation or narrative you have for such happenings?
I think there's three things to be said there. The first is that although you're right that humanist, it's an important humanist value that we should accept personal responsibility and that we should act, you know, responsibly in our actions. I don't think that necessarily goes hand in hand with the belief that we are totally in control. So, I mean, some humanists, particularly those who have studied a lot of science, a lot of physics, would say that actually everything is predetermined, you know, because X followed Y in the Big Bang, and because this atom moved here, and because this atom moved there, I'm going to go to the fridge after this conversation is done and pour myself a gin and tonic. That's just what's going to happen. I don't really have any agency about it. It's a series of atoms in the universe that have driven me inexorably to that point, you know. So does that mean that I am able to say as I do that, I couldn't have stopped this, I couldn't have made any other choice? No, it doesn't. So the first thing I think to say is that a belief that you should act as if you have autonomy and responsibility, because that's a better considered way to live, a more responsible way to live, a more thoughtful way to live, is different from saying that that means that every event is under your control. You have to accept that some things just are, you know, to some extent predetermined in the way that I've just described. The second thing is that I don't think a humanist feels the need to explain sort of unforeseen events. And I think this is sometimes, you know, that's a question that if you ask a humanist, you know, how do you explain these events that happen, these tragedies that happen, or these opportunities that come along? I think that's quite puzzling for a humanist to even consider that question, because it's so far outside of the frame of reference of a humanist view of things. Mm-hmm. You know, things happen because they happen. And it's, even if you're asking that question, you sort of almost have implied already that there could be a reason for it to happen. And a humanist doesn't believe that's even possible. You know, there's no outside deliberative agency like fate or any other force that's guiding things in any direction. So that's the second thing to say. And then I think the third thing to say is that even though all of that is true, and that, you know, everything that I've just said, that, you know, often we lack agency, and we're not completely in control of our things quite often, and the tragedies intrude into our lives just because they intrude into our lives, it's part of, you know, it's the lot of human beings that they have misfortunes as well as fortunes. Even all that having been said, I think it is still a core humanist belief that you can control how you greet these events. You know, you can
respond.
Exactly. That's how you respond to it. You can respond to adversity with resilience, courage, kindness, trust, and hope, or you can respond to adversity with despair, fatalism, anger, hostility, and resentment. You know, and if we try to develop ourselves so that we're the sort of people who respond in those positive ways, then I think you're doing a good job as far as the humanist is concerned, as far as the humanist view is concerned. So that would be, I think, the beginnings at least of a humanist approach to answering that question. Because, you know, into every life comes tragedy. Even, you know, even though we might be relatively more fortunate than each other or less fortunate than each other, as individuals, everyone's going to suffer. Everyone's life ends in death, for example, which is an ultimate reality for all of us. And everyone we know will die as well, many of them during our own lifetime, so that we have to go through that with them. So, you know, there's always tragedy. It's a fact. You know, suffering is a fact of human existence. And we don't get to decide, you know, often what happens to us, but we do get to decide within some limits, at least, how we respond to it. And I think that's the humanist point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the reason why people subscribe to a belief system is because they're afraid of the uncertainty of life. I mean, it's a given that if you're alive, you are going to face some challenges and things you can't predict, you know, the unpredictable events. So exactly. I think that's what people are looking for, that comfort.
I mean, you're right. There's good evidence for that claim for what you say. I mean,
if you
look around the world, countries that have strong social welfare systems, that have, you know, low income inequality, that have high standards of living, that have national health services and social welfare, people are far less religious in those countries. And religiosity is higher in countries where there's more suffering, you're closer to the breadline, you don't know whether your next meal is going to be your last, there's uncertainty. People, like you say, there's good reason to believe that it's when you're in those sorts of bad situations that you need something else to give you meaning, to tell you that your suffering is not in vain and that there is a meaning to it all. Yeah, you're right, unfortunately. Yeah.
And I think as human beings, we're storytellers and we need those narratives to make sense of things that we can't explain.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Just to continue on the point that I just made, you know, spirituality and faith-based belief systems, they offer comfort and they also offer identity, tradition, community, and a sense of belonging in general. So what are some of the other ways that people can find this, especially if they have grown up in a society where, you know, that's all they knew, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's difficult, isn't it? I mean, especially the last part of your question, when people have grown up in a situation where that's all they had, that is the thing that gave shape entirely to their to their experience. That's very difficult. And I think that's actually, I know this is sort of side a digression almost, your question, but I think that's actually one of the good reasons why we should raise children to understand that there are ranges and options in their lives. You know, I'm not one who thinks you should raise a child entirely in your own belief system. I think I'm someone who says you should make them aware that there are different ways of answering questions, different ways of making meaning, different views out there, because that in that way you're giving them a sort of a store of possible responses for the future if they find the ones that you believe in as a parent unlikely. You know, I think it is really unfortunate for people who have been given only one source of identity, one source of community, one source of comfort. If they then, you know, lose the beliefs, the problem is they might lose the values and the comforts that used to go along with them. So I think that's a really important point that we should all bear in mind. In terms of the places, the sources of identity, of comfort, of tradition, of a sense of belonging, a sense of meaning that people have who are not religious, there are just so many. I mean, the thing about a humanist approach to this question, the question of meaning, is that a humanist view is that there is not one single meaning to the universe. There's no objective meaning of life written into reality that is out there and we can go and find it like on some sort of quest for the grail that is outside of us, right? The humanist view is completely different. The humanist view is that we give meaning. We don't discover meaning, we create it. You know, meaning, we create meaning as we give significance to the things that happen to us in our lives as we move through the story of our own life. You said a moment ago, human beings are storytelling animals, and that's exactly right. And we don't just tell stories about the world around us to make sense of it. We tell stories about our own lives. You know, our own life is, my life is a story in my head. Your life is a story in your head. You're giving the events of your life significance and meaning as you move through them. And once you accept that that's what's happening, there is an almost infinite diversity of meanings, of identities, of sources of comfort, of sources of community that you might find for yourself. And so I think, you know, if I talk out of the context of the UK, where, you know, it's been decades, maybe 100 years or more, since religion has been the primary source of community or meaning or identity for people in this country, and they find their communities everywhere. They might find it locally, or they find communities of interest. You know, the UK has one of the most thriving civil societies in the world. Every night there are groups meeting above the local pub or in the bar, you know, groups with interests as wide as history or self-help or embroidery or yoga or, you know, any sort of activities that you can imagine. And people find a community of interest. So you find a community of locality, you find a community of interest. People adopt political causes or social activities, or they might, you know, think, I might think I'm a gardener, I'm a walker, I'm an activist for justice in this sphere, I'm a reader, I like novel. You know, there's all sorts of multiple sources. I like to think that as well as that, we could all develop an identity as human. I'm definitely a humanist who puts the human into humanist. I do think it's a good primary identity to try and form as a human being,
what
to understand.
Does that mean to you, seeing yourself as a human?
I think to me, it does different things for me. It does moral things for me. It also does personal comfort things for me. I find it comfortable to be nestled in a long story, you know, of human beings. I like to think about the people who came before me, the people who will hopefully come after me. You know, that big story. I mean, that's a huge, you know, fascinating story. Yeah. And so that gives me a sort of comfort being, you know, I'm at home in that narrative. It also, I think, has a moral purpose because it helps us understand that actually human beings are all the same species. We did all come from the same place. We're all going to the same place, you know, as well. And that we are of the same type. We're one humanity. Yeah. So I think it has a moral purpose if you can develop an identity as a human as well.
Yeah. You know, I just want to quickly mention that when I go to museums, like I went to the British Museum a couple of times, and I went to the Louvre, and whenever I see, you know, objects from like thousands of years ago, I just feel I have this sort of transcendent experience. I don't know if you get what I'm saying, but it's just
I know what you mean.
It feels so connected to that my humanity, and I can't believe that there were people like me living such a long time ago, and I just feel the sense of kinship with them. Just seeing a shoe that a little girl wore, you know, in Wales, maybe 2000 years ago. I mean, how amazing is that, right? Just to see.
Exactly. And that is a sort of humanist spirituality. Yeah. That is a humanist sense of transcendence.
Oh, is that? Okay. Oh, yeah. So I didn't have the word for it, but I'm getting what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think you can, situated in that place when those moments take you outside of yourself, in that you're suddenly aware of that continuity, that wider context, that story, and then it takes you back into yourself as well because you reconsider your own position in all of these things.
Absolutely.
And it's an amazing moment, and it's a bit like the way you think of yourself as being maybe at home in this universe or at home in this planet as well, you know. Yes. you can take a big step back, and then you take a return to yourself, and it changes the way that you think about things. And that sense of connectedness is definitely, sort of, the humanist philosopher Richard Norman has said that both those things, and he adds some others, are sources of humanist transcendence in his book on humanism that was a few years ago by Routledge. And that's definitely a sort of humanist spirituality.
Okay. Now I know. Now I have a word for it.
It's a good feeling.
That feeling. But what about, Andrew, what about the big questions, right? I mean, we can get context, we can get meaning by looking at our own lives and history, our ancestors. What about life's big questions? Where did we come from? Like, what is the meaning of life? Where do we go after we die? You know, because people want answers.
Yeah, but of course, ever since there have been human beings, we have asked ourselves these questions. You know, they are the questions that it makes sense to ask once you've got a certain level of material comfort and you're able to sit back for a minute and consider these points. And exactly, that's what you need first. And our earliest ancestors, you know, were obviously considering them. I think definitely from a humanist point of view, some of those questions are completely legitimate. I mean, questions of like, how should I live? How should we all live? You know, what is the future for humanity? Those are real questions. But some of the old style self-called sort of big questions for a humanist turn out not to be questions at all. Like, there's no sense for a humanist in asking, why are we here? Because there is no why. You know, there's no external objective. Why are we here? There's a narrative explanation for how human beings came about as a species, how societies developed, how civilizations developed, as we've just been talking about. And therefore, there's an explanation for why you're here and why I'm here and why we generally, how we have come to be in the places we are and the people we are and on the planet that we're on. But there is no answer to the question of why we're here, if that why is trying to suggest that there's some sort of agency or purpose outside of human beings that has brought us into existence or created us. So, you know, there are some questions, quite a lot of questions like that, that you just sort of have to dismiss if you're a humanist. They're not questions. They make as much sense to a humanist as, you know, well, they don't make any sense from inside a humanist frame of reference. Then there are other questions, like, for example, does the human being survive death? Which you can explore on the basis of, by applying, for example, in relation to that specific question, by applying physics and chemistry to our own biology, you can explain what happens, what is likely to happen to the human personality when the body dies, which is that it's going to disappear. It's going to dissipate because it's an artifact of the brain. The mind is an artifact of the brain, and the human personality is therefore it's reasonable to assume, goes out of existence at the point when the body ceases to operate in that way. And so even there, you know, I think that's a very different way of answering that big question from the way that other people have. So I would say some of these so-called big questions just evaporate for a humanist. Mm-hmm. And some of them we deal with through scientific explanations.
Yeah. Now, I'm just saying you have to be strong emotionally to deal with such a harsh, potentially a harsh truth, you know?
I think so.
Because honestly, I have an uncle who handed me Richard Dawkins' book, God Delusion.
Oh, yes.
After reading it, I didn't feel good.
Oh, dear.
It felt like I had to swallow a really, you know, a deep, what's the expression? I had to swallow a very bitter pill.
A bitter pill.
Bitter pill, yeah. And I was just, I said, oh, that doesn't feel good. You have to be strong. You have to, I just think so.
I guess it's a question of what's better. Do you want to live your life on the basis of the explanations that have the strongest evidence for them at any particular time? You know, do you care about truth? Do you want to be, do you want to live a truthful life? Are you happy to put up with a little bit of comforting fantasy? I mean, I would say that the truth is always best, almost always best, you know? Yeah. And we see even today around our world in the political dimension how badly wrong things can go if you just try and lose yourself in the happy lie rather than face the truth and the reality of the world. That's what I would say.
Definitely coming to the forefront out here in the United States.
Absolutely. I mean, what a lesson to the world. Yeah. Yeah. But that's not a pointless comparison, actually, if you think about it, because there is, you know, some people can say, well, maybe I do want to be a little bit deluded. Maybe I do want to be happy. But, you know, a delusion can give you some, leads to, you know, can lead to pretty wrong actions. And people say, what harm does it do if I believe in God, even if God doesn't exist, or if I believe in this, even if it doesn't exist? And you think, okay, well, a delusion might be comforting. You might be comforted to think that the person that you love loves you back, you know, and maybe sometimes that's nice. But what about if you've never met them and you're their stalker, and you know, and that story ends in a terrible, terrible, you know, tragedy.
what is that fantasy going to cost you ultimately?
Exactly.
Yeah,
better to face the truth, I think. I mean, as it happens, in relation to death, I don't think the truth is that distressing necessarily. I've always found it much more distressing to believe that there might be some sort of afterlife.
Really?
I think that's a horrendous idea.
Well,
I mean, I'd like to think that, you know, when I'm dead, it's over, really, because the idea of carrying on existing in some disembodied state or like infinity, that's a horrendous thought, infinity. You know, I think a lot of children, when they think about infinity, get quite scared about it. I did, I remember. When I first thought about that concept, probably because some religious person had brought it into my mind, and you'd lie in bed at night and think about sort of like what forever meant. Like, is it tomorrow and then the next day and then the next day, but it never ended. And I just found that absolutely terrifying. And I think it is, I think if you really think about infinity, for example, or eternity, it is quite a terrifying prospect, because everything that we value, everything that gives our lives meaning, everything that we sort of enjoy, I think we enjoy and we value and get meaning from it because it's sort of circumscribed in time. Like, this conversation is very pleasant. It's very nice to be meeting you, but, and no offense, I wouldn't want it to last forever. You know, this conversation is going to be interesting and fulfilling and a happy experience for both of us because it has structure, because it had a beginning, we're in the middle of it, and it will have an end. You know, I think life's like that. If you go on and on and on and on and on, that's meaningless. That's the nasty idea to my mind.
I never thought of it that way. Yeah.
I'd like a few decades more, don't get me wrong. I mean, maybe 200 years. Like, if we could have a longer life.
You want your full term.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
In good health and all the rest of it. But
yes.
On and on. No thanks.
Yeah, well, I think everyone has different emotional landscapes. Because for some people, just thinking that this is the end is scary. You know, they want to have another shot. They want to get it
right. A humanist would say, you know, take that shot now.
take that shot now. Yeah.
Don't wait about. Yeah.
Why take the chance, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go on to the last question. I want to talk about some of the very important, like, humanistic values that you believe in, like kindness, equality, dignity, social justice. And I find this, honestly, I find this the most appealing part of the humanistic philosophy. Tell us more about this.
I think a lot of people find this appealing because it's and this is probably the biggest contribution that humanism and the humanist view has made sort of to the world. Because these days, 200 years on from, you know, the real beginning of the spread of humanist ideas, and when you might say humanist ideas really took off in the sort of mid-20th century, really a lot of religious people now also believe these things. You know, humanist ideas have had an enormous impact even on people with religious beliefs. You know, the idea that human beings all have an equal claim to happiness, and the idea that there is such thing as social justice, and you know, which should involve every human being. I mean, that's the key thing, isn't it? You know, so often the religions of the world, the philosophers of the world have said, oh yeah, everyone should have this wonderful thing. But by everyone, I don't mean, and then they've gone through a list of people who aren't included in their definition of human, right? But for the humanist, that is not on the cards. You know, every human being, by virtue of their humanity, has a claim on human dignity, a claim to justice in the society that they live in, and a call on your kindness, the same as you have a call on theirs. And I think that that idea, that humanist idea, is extremely compelling. It's informed some of the biggest human rights revolutions, you know, of previous decades. How do we develop it? I think it's really difficult because human beings have a nature such that if society is comfortable and we're happy and we were well loved in our childhood and we were raised in society, you're probably going to be good most of the time.
Right.
That's going to happen. It's because you're a social animal, and that's how we've evolved. We've evolved with social instincts that will allow us to be kind and cooperative and sharing with the people immediately around us. Right. The two problems that we've got to deal with that are barriers to those natural instincts having full reign in today's society, the two barriers we've got to deal with are that now those instincts don't have to just be applied to the people immediately around us, our family and our tribe or even our nation. They've got to be applied universally. You know, we've got to see human beings as one family.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you know, we'll destroy the world. Certainly destroy ourselves completely. And that's really hard. So I think that comes back to what I was saying at the beginning. We've got to try and find a way to develop a human identity, to make people feel an affiliation with humanity. You know, say, yeah, I am a human being. It's because I'm a human being that I care about these other people, that they should care about me. Humanity is a unit. We need to think about it in those terms. Charles Darwin, who's very optimistic, as many humanists are often accused of being, but was very optimistic, he said, you know, the boundaries that stop you thinking of the whole of humanity as one family are just artificial. You know, once we realize that we've all come from the same place, those artificial boundaries will just break down straight away, and we will suddenly realize, you know, that we're all one. I think that's over-optimistic, because I think the evidence is that it's so easy for people to call us back into nationalism, into populism, into racism. Yes. It only takes one bad but powerful person to initiate the trend that pulls us back you know, we know it, like we were talking about a moment ago. So I think that's one of the barriers. I think it has to be done by working hard to foster values of cooperation and also human identity, like I said. I think the other problem, though, is that not only is it difficult to expand out those social instincts which make us behave well to the whole world rather than just our family, I think it's also difficult to do that in a situation where there is inequality, there is lack of opportunity, and there is hostility and resentment that is fostered not just by nasty strongmen, not only is it possible for them to actively whip up sort of division, but division is created by the inequality that exists in our society. You know, our social instincts, which are to be kind, to be compassionate, to share, to cooperate, they only work if we're on an equal basis with the people around us. You know, there's a reason why small tribes worked that way and families work that way, because you've got sort of equality between you. Yeah. But if you're very conscious, instead of being equal with the people around you, that actually you're really unequal, that's very difficult. And of course, not every child is loved. Not every child is raised in an environment that, you know, brings out the best in them. So I think through our education system, through our social services, by extending the opportunity to be free and to be fulfilled to every child, by the active intervention of, you know, states and agencies that will improve the life chances of people, as well as foster the values of cooperation we're talking about, I think they're the ways to improve the world and to develop kindness, equality, you know, dignity, social justice. And the good news is that when you try and develop those, you are going with the grain of humanity. You're not working to save a fallen, dirty creature. You know, you are just working to bring out the best that is already there in human beings. You just have to find the way to do it.
Find a way to do it, yeah. Wow, I'm loving the picture that you're painting, Andrew. That's exactly what we should be working on.
It's a better tomorrow.
But what do we do on an individual level? Like, if I'm not a leader of a country, if I don't have that kind of power, what can I do? What can I do in my own backyard, so to speak, to really contribute towards?
Oh, I think that's where it begins. Right. I think it begins in this, as Eleanor Roosevelt said, you know, human rights, they begin in the small places. They begin in our lives. It begins in the relationships that we, you know, pursue with our neighbors and in our community. As citizens of democracies, of course, we do have an extremely important obligation to vote the right way and to be active politically and to, you know, I mean, that is absolutely our obligation. And it can't be ignored. And it's, you know, citizenship is an active ongoing process, not just at the ballot box, but in general, but also in our purely in our social lives, we can work to you know, further these values in our communities and find the ways, look around ourselves and say, you know, what is it, what cause can I get involved in, what movement can I get involved in, but also just what can I do as I walk through my life to role model kindness, to role model equality, to be the sort of person that will hopefully inspire others around me to treat people the way that I think that they should be treated. I think that you can, this comes back, doesn't it, to seeing your life as a story as well. You know, you can make it a good, kind, compassionate story. That would be no bad thing if at the beginning and the end of every day, everyone asks themselves, you know, what would the chapter of today look like if I was reading this? Would I be proud of what this character had done in the last 24 hours? Or would I feel that they were the baddie? Would I feel ashamed? And I think, after all, if everyone did that, then the net effect on the level of kindness and compassion in the world would be incalculable.
Yeah. And the good thing is now we have the internet that offers us a platform, social media offers that platform where we can express ourselves and we can really express these values and model behavior, the behaviors that you're talking about. So, and you're certainly doing that, you and your organization. So that's...
Thank you.
So Andrew, it's been wonderful talking to you. You and your team, you're doing some really great work and bringing some of these value systems and these beliefs to the forefront. And I really appreciate all the work that you do.
Well, thank you for what you're doing. I'm going to listen to your podcast in the future with keen enthusiasm.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that. So just very quickly, so you have a book called The Little Book of Humanism, right?
I do, that's right. I'm not sure how it's available in the United States, actually.
It's available on Amazon.
Is it available on Amazon? Okay, fine. The Little Book of Humanism that came out just last year, 2020, with Alice Roberts, who's the current president of Humanist UK. And it's available online. It's just an attempt, really, to give in a few simple chapters – just some of the some hint of the treasures in the humanist tradition. You know, so there's access to 3,000 years really in East and West of humanist.
I like the illustrations and all.
It's got pictures. Not every book on humanism has pictures, I can tell you. In fact, I think this is the only one. It's not philosophical. It's not dry in that way.
Yeah. And I think that's what intimidates people about reading all these kind of.
I think so. This book's not like that. It's called The Little Book of Humanism for a reason. I mean, it's little, but I think it packs a punch.
Yeah. And the website of your organization is?
Well, Humanists UK is humanists.uk. And then there's also Humanists International, which is humanists.international. And in the United States, of course, there's the American Humanist Association.
Oh, is there? Okay.
Yeah, which you can also Google. So the American Humanist Association is one of the oldest humanist associations in the world and is well worth a follow.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew. I mean, I really appreciate you opening our minds and trying to see the world from a different point of view.
Thank you, Selena, especially so early in the morning for you.
I know. I hope I did okay.
It was lovely. Now you enjoy your day. You know, it's a reward.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you enjoy your evening out there in the UK.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed what you just heard, please subscribe to my podcast and feel free to share it with your friends and family. Take care and speak soon.